Welcome to Wharton India Economic Forum's podcast. We are Wharton's premier India-focused conference. In these episodes, we will host eminent leaders, academics, and young professionals to discuss India's evolution into a prominent economic global power. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Nayan Bader. And in today's episode, I'm joined by Sandeep Bhamar. Sandeep is the founder and managing partner of Green Frontier Capital, which is India's first venture capital fund focused exclusively on investing in climate change. He's also an adjunct professor of finance at Eisenberg School of Management, focused on teaching sustainable finance. He's the winner of Meaningful Business 100 Award, given to business leaders who are engaged in furthering UN Sustainable Development Goals. We hope you enjoy this conversation around how Sandeep combined his vocation of investing with his passion towards sustainability and a greener future.
Thank you, Nayan. It's a pleasure and an honor to serve, on this platform today at Wharton, which obviously is a school that I didn't go to, but a competitor to one that I did go to, which is Cornell.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Sandeep. To begin with, I'm very curious to hear more about your personal journey. It spanned from Cornell MBA to investment banking to public markets investing, being a PM at hedge funds, then starting your own early stage fund. Can you talk to us about this journey in the sense of what were your guiding principles all throughout and how did you find your way to start an early stage VC fund in India?
Sure, thanks. It's a very interesting question. I started my journey on the investment banking side in the mid-90s, when there weren't enough professionals available to bridge the gap between possessing knowledge of India and its capital markets, and on the other side, the ease of dealing with a Western institutional audience, that was ready to invest in India and was looking for professionals to engage with on similar lines that they'd been used to in the Western world. So I happened to have actually caught that wave when Indian companies were actually, raising institutional capital in the West. There was a flood of paper actually coming in the form of GDRs, ADRs, and of course, local, equity participation opportunities. A lot of investment banks at the time were looking for people who could actually do that effectively because, there weren't too many people who could do that. So I had, that was my foray into investment banking. I built out Credit Lyonnais' India business in the United States. Did extremely well at it. By the time I joined and left Credit Lyonnais in 2000, it was ranked as the number one institutional agency for research, sales, and trading in the United States. And then I moved over to HSBC to try and replicate that effort. And by the time I moved over from the sell side to the buy side in 2004, HSBC, which was obviously largely known as a commercial bank, became a much better ranked institution, on the investment banking league tables in the US. And my move to the hedge fund side in 2004 also coincided with the emergence of India as a serious capital market for institutional investors in the alternative markets to deploy capital. So I did that from 2004 till about 2016-17. But along the way, I also invested my own personal money as an angel investor in various startups. I dabbled with the startup ecosystem and made a lot of money in my personal capacity. And a lot of my LPs actually, who I was to talk to on a one-on-one basis, expressed the desire to invest in some of these opportunities themselves. But our fund had no way of accessing those opportunities because they were very small or did not meet the mandate of the fund.
Mm.
So when we actually had the pandemic strike in 2020, when things became slow, I decided to revisit what I wanted to do and the startup space, which obviously was very exciting to me because I had mentored several of the companies that I had invested in as well as a matter of personal interest,
right.
and did extremely well. Then became the inspiration behind starting a venture fund. And then thematically, I decided to focus on climate change because obviously it's a big pressing issue of the hour. It's an area that I had considerable interest in personally, just from an academic perspective, and also as an investor myself in some really interesting climate tech companies in early stage in the United States. And so I decided to leverage off of that experience to put together India's first climate-only focused VC fund. So that's been my kind of journey from investment banking into the buy side, and then in the buy side from the hedge fund side to the venture cap side.
That's a very interesting career arc. And I want to specifically touch upon the inspiration that you talked about to start a climate-focused, climate-only fund. The strategy has been around a while, even in early-stage investing, where generalist funds would have some focus on the sector. What is the gap that you saw that pushed you to start something exclusively focused on climate change?
So two things there. Obviously, first is that there is an unparalleled momentum with regards to the opportunity of investing in climate change and climate stabilization. And, obviously, the fact is that we are at a point where, you know, India is a pretty significant contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. In order of magnitude, it's China, the United States, and India.
Right.
And obviously, China's industrial development started much before India's did. And there's been a lot of manufacturing capacity that has been built in China that today, if you were to actually ask China to pivot to a green infrastructure and to reduce their emissions, they would find it a lot more difficult to do that because of legacy issues. And also without sacrificing economic growth. The advantage, obviously, that India has is that our industrial growth trajectory started much later. So we have fewer legacy issues. Then the next thing, obviously, is that, there are various companies in India that are well positioned to provide goods and services to decarbonize some impact of the economy. And these are India's largest markets that we're talking about: energy, transportation, food, agriculture. And the foundational technologies that accompany investing in these sectors are posing a serious threat to their fossil fuel counterparts in terms of both pricing as well as performance. So adoption will be much quicker than one would like to think and believe. And along with a faster adoption and pivot also comes very high returns. So that was effectively the gap that we saw, that not enough people were investing and in fact are still not investing in some of these technologies for various reasons that we can actually talk about. But we believe that that was a significant opportunity that, provided for us to, invest in and take advantage of it.
That's interesting. And so, When you started this fund, obviously investors and LPs also want high quality returns. And with your mandate to focus on companies in climate change and green tech, what is the philosophy that you use to invest in these companies? What are your criteria? And what are the kind of entrepreneurs you want to back?
Yeah, so multiple questions there, right? First thing that we're focusing on in the climate space is the mitigation aspect, where we are focusing the bulk of our investments. As you know, climate finance is focused on three main areas: climate mitigation, climate adaptation, and climate resilience in terms of technologies. Adaption, by its very nature, is a medium-term slash longer gestation activity, which is capital intensive and will require investment in green infrastructure. Mitigation involves investing in technologies that are designed to outcompete their fossil fuel incumbents in the near term. Given that we are an early stage VC firm, and as an early VC firm, we seek to invest in companies that can deliver venture scale opportunities, there is a focus therefore on mitigation. Clearly, we are investing in companies that have an early stage venture profile, and right, these are seen in mitigation vertical. So we look for young, dynamic entrepreneurs who are delivering breakthrough innovation to align India's SDGs with the UN's SDGs, but more specifically in the area of climate action, climate change. So that is basically our overall philosophy behind the fund.
Very interesting. So that's a very interesting way of segmenting your fund strategy as well, especially on mitigation. Just talking about this, and I want to jump into more themes later, but broadly, what sectors or themes excite you the most as you look at 2023 and beyond and fund strategy for Green Frontier?
So when we do a portfolio construction, we debated this internally, and obviously energy transition is a very, very big part of most economies' greenhouse gas emission led issues. But along with energy transition comes a lot of political sensitivity and a lot of policy making. And the reason for that obviously is governments change, and with changed governments, you have changed policies. And then sometimes government make policies at the center, which are great, but you know, you need follow through at the state level. The states may or may not comply all the time with central policies. So we, as a venture cap fund, have tried to stay away as far as possible from energy transition as a theme. The interesting thing about India is that if you look at the composition of greenhouse gas emissions in India, 20% of India's greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture. Another 20% comes from transportation and the ecosystem built around transportation. And another 5 to 6% come from industrial and manufacturing processes. So our portfolio has been, and these are, by the way, low-hanging fruits, because there isn't a whole lot of policy making that happens in these areas. And so we've decided to focus on largely these sectors because they're less politically sensitive and have less policy involvement from the government perspective. So if you were to actually go into our website and look at our portfolio construction, you'll find really interesting companies in these sectors that are well represented.
Got it. And so I think you talked about transportation, energy transition, and manufacturing as the key area.
Agriculture, food tech, and mobility / transportation.
Got it. I think
and
one of the
and a little bit of industrial manufacturing processes, and also we are also looking at some consumer lifestyle businesses as well. But I would say the bulk of our investments are ag tech, food tech, and mobility.
Interesting. And so I think one of the areas that I'm also very curious about is mobility, particularly, and the EV transition that the entire world is making. And so I would love to double click on this a little bit. I believe you have also bagged some companies in the EV space.
Yes, we have. We've actually built our entire EV thesis around the entire ecosystem, all the way from financing of EVs to the actual manufacture of EVs and the charging infrastructure in connection therewith.
Interesting. So could you talk about that a little bit more as to how you went about going about the entire value chain Did you believe that everything all the way from rare earth, mineral mining, battery tech, vehicle tech, charging infrastructure, did you see interesting plays across that value chain? Or did you feel that there are certain of these sectors which have a higher right to win for Indian companies or models that could serve the Indian customers better than the others? I'm just very curious to understand how you went about constructing the portfolio. And I'm sure it's a work in progress. I'm sure you're also looking for the companies to add.
Yeah, I mean, so as a philosophy, we've actually, decided to approach businesses that are platform businesses, where the power of the network effect actually plays in a big role and where the businesses are not capital intensive and are largely driven by tech. So if you look at, for example, our, and in terms of form factor, we've decided to focus really on businesses in the EV space that are targeted towards two-wheelers and three-wheelers in particular. And there are very clear reasons for why we like the two-wheeler and three-wheeler space in the EV more than the four-wheeler space. And I'm happy to expand on that if you want me to, but...
No, absolutely. I think it was going to be my next question anyway. So I'd love to double click on what made you excited about two-wheelers.
Yeah, so we are firmly of the belief that the entire EV revolution in India is going to be driven by two-wheelers and three-wheelers. And the reasons are, quite simple if you were to do the math of it. So from a total cost of ownership and a total cost of operations perspective, what is clear is that EVs are, from a total cost of operation perspective, much cheaper than their fossil fuel counterparts. There is almost a savings of 70%, in terms of basically operating an EV vis-a-vis an ICE vehicle. But where the two-wheelers and three-wheelers actually really become exciting is that both two-wheelers and three-wheelers can be retrofit. And at the margin, the cost of retrofitting a two-wheeler or a three-wheeler is de minimis compared to the amount of asset sweating you can do on account of the asset getting converted from an ICE vehicle to a EV, because basically, making that switch actually doubles the life of your asset. So assuming that you're able to basically continue to sweat the asset at the same rate that you've done when it was an ICE vehicle, the revenue or the profits generated from operating the vehicle over the extended life more than allows you to recover for the cost of the retrofit. So in the case of a three-wheeler, for example, a retrofit tends to be in the range of 1,25,000 rupees to 1,90,000 rupees. And in the case of a two-wheeler, it ranges anywhere between 70,000 to 150,000, depending on what the situation is. And that has largely to do with the battery cost itself. But what happens is, if you look at the average life of a three-wheeler, which is ICE-based, the life tends to be somewhere around 7 or 8 years, useful life. Obviously, people in India use vehicles beyond their useful life. But by converting it to a EV, you can actually extend the useful life to 14 years. So you get another a good 6 to 7 years on the vehicle. And the kind of money that you make if you were to operate that versus the cost of the retrofit makes it, commercially a positive, decision to make. On the other hand, if you look at a four-wheeler, unless you have a commercial usage of a four-wheeler, the problem is that if you're just going to basically drive a four-wheeler from home to office and back, and with the inability of you to basically retrofit a four-wheeler, the outgoing cost on day one is very large. And even the cost of operating the asset and the savings generated in connection therewith actually take a much longer period of time for you to recover the cost of the vehicle that you put up upfront. So in terms of NPV approach, your two-wheeler or a three-wheeler decision-making is a much higher positive NPV approach than you have with a four-wheeler. And therefore, the adoption that is actually taking place at the four-wheeler level in India or anywhere in the globe is much slower than the kind of adoption and pivot we are actually seeing towards e-two-wheelers and three-wheelers in India. Does that answer your question?
That does. That does. In fact, in my previous role as an early stage VC with Matrix in India, I was involved with a couple of companies, Oerikshaw in the three-wheeler space and Ola in the two-wheeler space, both focusing on solving issues which were pretty similar, with ride-hailing for Oerikshaw as a focus and Ola Electric also finding both retail and commercial applications for its two-wheelers. So I completely echo this thought and strategy on where four-wheelers worked. And I believe you have bagged BlueSmart as one of the companies which focuses on more asset sweating of four-wheelers, which makes sense as per the thesis.
Exactly. And it's actually a platform business, because effectively what it does is it subleases the vehicles, and it does exactly a very, very similar thing what an Uber and Ola does, but with the difference that it actually owns charging stations. So it's actually creating a lot of disruption because they've solved the chicken and egg problem, because you can't actually build out a large commercial fleet until you have access to charging stations. And you can't basically build out large charging stations until you have access to a large commercial fleet. And they have both. So they are a pretty fantastic platform, off of which I think the entire ride-hailing business in India is going to be completely, ride-sharing business is going to be completely redefined.
It's interesting. And so this was, I would believe, on within the value chain. This was just on vehicle tech and the commercial applications of electric vehicles. Do you feel there are
then,
other
sectors? Then in terms of your other points, charging infra, whether it's battery tech, mineral mining. So let me quickly talk a little bit on battery tech. The fact of the matter is that India needs to address its issue of access to lithium ion. And as you know, much of the EV revolution is being driven by access to lithium, because lithium is actually what goes into the batteries. Now, China controls 70% of the world's lithium refining and processing capacity and has taken the lead in producing low-cost, high-output batteries. And what that implies is the greater the EV adoption, the more likely that China will dominate transportation globally. So if energy security is a driving consideration for nations to reduce their reliance on regions that are oil rich, then surely that all we're doing is basically shifting the geographical dependence from the Middle East to China.
Interesting. Yeah.
And therefore, in my view, battery tech ultimately has to be an area of focus, but I'm not so sure yet that we have actually created anything that can actually address requirements on a global scale. There are some very interesting companies, and I was on an interview last week where I spoke about some very interesting startups coming out of our scientific institutes, where some interesting scientists are working on providing an alternative to lithium by way of zinc gel, for example, which has already proven at a lab level that from an energy production perspective, it's able to do the same thing at half the cost as lithium without having the other disadvantages of lithium, which is that lithium doesn't really work in an area where the climate is very hot. Otherwise, you're going to keep finding the batteries going up in flames, which has been the case in India. But then there are other issues with zinc gel, such as the inability of zinc to maintain a memory post-charging, which obviously lithium does. So I think, I strongly believe that India is a scale market. And obviously, we want to invest in businesses which are less capital intensive. So therefore, while we're keeping our eyes, firmly on interesting innovation happening in the area, we haven't really yet invested in anything in the battery tech space. Similarly, on rare earth mineral mining, there too, again, very capex intensive, lots of proven technology required. And so we are actually just looking at those areas, but we haven't found anything that is exportable from India's perspective on a global scale yet.
Got it. And when you think about charging infrastructure, do you believe that has to be solved as part of a platform, say how BlueSmart is doing it? Or do you believe there's a play, or like, for instance, or even how Tesla does it for its customers? I believe even US government has, in the recent infrastructure bill, they have earmarked some money for charging infrastructure.
Yeah.
Do you believe it has to be solved at the governmental institutional level or the platform level? Or do you believe there's a play for individual charging infrastructure providers as we have higher adoption of two-wheelers and three-wheelers in the country at least?
So, in fact, one of our investee companies may have actually addressed that very successfully. And the name of the company is Battery Smart. And I really urge you to look at it, which is that they've completely eliminated the need for setting up physical infrastructure. And the way they've done that is by setting up a battery swapping network instead of setting up a battery infrastructure network. So effectively, Battery Smart is an app which allows three-wheeler owners or two-wheeler owners to download the app and for a subscription fee, get access to the nearest, Kirana Walas, for example, who are largely available within city limits, who have access to Battery Smart's pre-charged batteries. And why this is such a relevant topic is obviously India, as you know, is a very, very dense market. And the use of electrical vehicles, the way we see it, is going to be largely restricted to within city limits rather than long distance because of, you know, obvious areas right. of concern like range anxiety.
Yeah.
And within city limits, if you study the, urban infrastructure in India, there isn't any land available to set up physical, charging stations. So obviously you can actually partner with a housing society and use their infrastructure as a charging station. You can actually tie up with malls. You can do all of that, which is obviously what we're seeing. But unlike the United States, where there's a lot of open land, India obviously is very, very dense. But the way to solve that problem and how Battery Smart has done it is that they've actually tied up with these Kirana Walas who got these pre-charged batteries. So all you have to do is if you're actually running out of battery charge, you go to the nearest Kirana Wala, and within 5 minutes, you take out your battery, you give him your used battery. And he gives you a brand new battery. And why that actually works really well is there's no long charging times required. There's no physical infrastructure required. And particularly for the people who operate these two-wheelers and three-wheelers, they are actually, employees by the day. And they rent right. these vehicles for the day. So spending 2 hours inside a charging station and having traffic ahead of you to do the same is not an option. So Battery Smart's adoption from a subscriber perspective has been massive. They've been delivering incredibly high growth numbers. And so India, with its reputation for jugaad, as they say, has solved, I think, the charging infrastructure problem through these battery swapping networks. And I'm sure that there are others in the mix also that will be doing that. But obviously, Battery Smart is India's largest interoperability network today and has a big, big lead time. When we invested with them, they used to do, 1,000 battery swaps a day, 1,500 battery swaps a day. Today, they're doing an incredible amount of battery swaps. So they're doing close to about 25,000 to 28,000 battery swaps a day.
Oh, incredible growth. And congrats on all the progress.
No, thanks. That's, obviously more congratulations due to the founders of the company who've done so well.
Absolutely. I want to switch gears within EVs. For instance, what would be on your wish list, government of India and regulators, that we could do to promote the space more. And I'm trying to draw a parallel with, say, what's been happening in the US for our listeners, where in Jan 21, US President Biden promised to fully replace the federal government's fleet of roughly 600,000 plus vehicles with US-made EVs. They recently, I believe a few days ago, also came out with a tax credit system for buying electric vehicles.
Yes.
To contrast, what do you think has government of India and regulators done well? And what do you believe would take us to the next level?
So in that regards, I'd firstly say that India has done a really good job on the overall compliance aspect. But obviously, always more remains to be done. It's one of the few countries that is ahead of its committed targets made at the COP21 Paris summit. But as I explained to you earlier, more needs to be happening at the state level. As you know, state governments are ultimately custodians of regional policy and executors of the programs that have been constructed and designed at the center. But having said that, there are multiple things that the government of India has recently done. I mean, I don't know if you saw that India has recently cleared the amendments to the Energy Conservation Law. And the Energy Conservation Law's aim was to facilitate the achievement of COP26 goals and introduce various concepts such as the use of non-fossil fuel sources and carbon trading to ensure, faster decarbonization of the economy. But there wasn't anything that was said on similar lines to what actually happened with the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States. So
right.
I feel that we need, using user of energy efficient products or environmental friendly products in India should be allotted green credits, which can be either redeemed at the point of sale against other statutory dues to the government like taxes, etc. So obviously that would be a pretty fantastic move because it would actually encourage people to go out and buy more products, two-wheelers, three-wheelers, four-wheelers, which are electrical in nature, or even buy, home, electrical devices, that obviously reduce the reliance on fossil fuel as a source of energy. And also there are various other things that need to be done. So, for example, the carbon credits that have been earned by an investor, one can suggest that they be allowed to be redeemed against tax and other statutory dues. There is what you call a corporate social or responsibility obligation that has been envisaged under Section 135 of the Companies Act of 2013. So the government may also consider offsetting some carbon credits against this corporate social responsibility that will then enable corporate entities to actually invest more in this kind of infrastructure. So, these are some of the suggestions that I have, and we can go on. But
no, that's great. So as we talk about electric vehicles, another issue that comes in is that of what's powering the shift to electric vehicles, particularly the sources of energy that we have that is powering this shift. And I believe there needs to be a transition at the same time from fossil fuel sources to non-fossil fuel sources if we are to truly call the EV revolution a completely green revolution. Right? And now, in that sense, what do you believe that shift looks like? Should we at the same time parallelly do this focus as a country, as an economy towards non-fossil fuel sources? It's been a big, big target, but I'm just trying to overlay this with the massive push across the governments in the world that are pushing regulation to remove ICE vehicles completely and focus on electric vehicles.
Again, very, very hard question, right? So while the TCO for EVs and particularly e-two-wheelers and three-wheelers, like we discussed, is much, much lower for ICE. And what is clear is that cities would be much better off without the exhaust fumes of internal combustion engines. There are a number of questions that still remain unanswered, and I'd like to kind of bring up some of those points, right, that people should consider. There is an argument, obviously, that electricity generation causes its own pollution, especially in countries like India, where our electricity is largely dependent upon coal-fired plants. So the carbon emissions that are saved by reliance on an electrical vehicle form factor, it is argued, can be negated by the emissions of the power plants, especially if the electrical vehicle revolution is to take off. Then you need to add more additional capacity. And so the fumes that are being or the emissions that will be emitted from those additional power plants, will that really not negate the savings that we have from the emission of cars? So that's point number one. The second thing, obviously, is we've just discussed this as well, is where is the charging infrastructure for our entire ecosystem of vehicles? Just to share with you, there are 25 million two-wheelers in India, and last year alone, 5 million new cars came on the road. So in order to basically transition that kind of volume to an electrical vehicle revolution driven volume, you know, you need the charging infrastructure. Then, of course, there are other issues that when you have such a large ecosystem, there is a dependence on charging, and therefore that will put pressure on our grids. So grid failure resulting as the resulting as a byproduct of the load coming from the vast amount of charging required could also have some very catastrophic consequences. And then, of course, there are long charging times and batteries not having enough capacity to cover long distances, covering range anxiety, which would complicate the problem further. And lastly, of course, is the issue of dependence on China. So when you consider all of these issues, how easy is it really to move towards non-fossil fuels to push EVs as a viable solution to the climate problem is one that I think a lot of people are trying to answer, and there's not a very clear answer on that.
Continues to be a problem that we need to address and solve going forward. But there are things to be optimistic about within India. India was ranked in the top 5 countries in the climate change performance index and one of the best among the large economies. There's also a lot of capacity that has been committed that will come online in the next decade, roughly 500 gigawatts worth, by 2030, which, as the target puts it, should be equal to 50% of all our needs. Large conglomerates, I believe, are leading the charge of investing in that infrastructure. For instance, Adani is coming up with a power plant in collaboration with the Rajasthan government, investing about $7 billion to generate 10,000 megawatts. Reliance has pledged roughly $80 billion for clean energy after making its fortune with petrochemicals. I believe they're also realizing that the future is cleaner fuels. Do you believe all this investment creates any opportunity for early stage companies or any themes or subsectors that excite you within this massive tailwind of non-fossil fuel based electricity generation in India?
Yeah, I mean, there are multiple themes that one can play on the back of this. So green hydrogen obviously is one very big area. If you are trying to build out a vehicle transition away from fossil fuel-based vehicles, and if lithium is not a viable solution for the reasons we've talked about, then green hydrogen obviously becomes a very, very big area of focus. Obviously, there's a lot of capex involved in that, and the cost of green hydrogen has to be brought down to a level where it becomes economically viable. But I do think that with the investments being made by both Adani and Ambani, the industrial houses of Reliance and Gautam Adani, I think we are well on our way there. Plus, there are other areas like manufacturing and industrial processes. We've looked at a very interesting company in India called Chakra Innovation, which actually creates devices that fit on diesel gensets and help capture emission from industrial processes. And then with the emissions that are captured, there is a conversion into industrial grade inks that are then produced and sold. Is another theme that we've played, in our portfolio. So there are a lot of interesting themes available and to play this. And clearly, I would say that the leader among the pack is the green hydrogen theme.
That's exciting, and Godspeed to all the companies working in this space. I would love to switch gears and focus on ESG investing as well. I believe you're also an adjunct professor at Eisenberg School of Management, and you focus specifically on sustainable finance there.
Yes, that's correct.
Which would help students marry the concepts of finance with ESG considerations in the decision-making process. I want to double-click on this a little bit. Even you as an investor, how do you really assess ESG rating of your target companies? Because I believe there's no standardization, right?
There is no standardization. Correct.
Exactly. You have services like Novata, launched by S&P Global and Hamiltonian and Omidyar, or you have ESG Data Convergence Project, launched by another consortium, including Carlyle and BCG. It just feels that it is such a minefield for an investor to navigate on what really counts or what should one focus on or look at as a source of truth. What is your advice for investors?
Yeah, so we have, what's really interesting is nowadays the LPs themselves insist that you monitor, ESG metrics. And when you're a climate player, then obviously climate metrics, to ensure that the companies that you've invested in are doing exactly what they said they would do when you invest in them. And so what we've looked at is for each of the companies that we've invested in, we have asked them to provide to us operating metrics that we are then able to convert into tons of carbon dioxide, sequestered or avoided, using standardized indexes that are available to us. So, for example, in the case of mobility companies, we actually look at the number of zero emission kilometers that have been generated on account of those mobility companies' operating activities. So we then take those. And then we use, a third-party source in the United States, EPA.gov. And then we use what each zero emission kilometer actually means in terms of carbon dioxide emissions saved. And then we do that, and then we convert that further into, the number of trees saved based on the number of trees that would have had to be planted in order to generate the same amount of oxygen to sequester the carbon dioxide, right? So if you go into our website, we actually get these metrics from our companies on a monthly basis and then do the calculations ourselves. Obviously, the caveat that we provide on our website is that we take the data that has been provided to us in terms of operating metrics at face value. So we don't audit those, but we do all the mathematical calculations ourselves and provide the details on a company by company basis. Now, what's really interesting is if we see trends, obviously that are declining in nature, then we actually go back to the companies and ask them questions like, what are they doing differently that is leading to less carbon, sequestration happening on result of their activities? Have they changed their business model? have the market dynamics changed? So by looking at trends, at what they do, we are in a position to kind of provide inputs to help them remain on track and scale what they're doing.
And how do you quantify some of these qualitative measures like good governance or employment, some of these which can only be, which are reported as a qualitative measure?
So women employment, for example, is a number, right, that we can actually get from a company. So one of the companies we invested in is a hydroponic farm. It's India's largest single location hydroponic farm. And, you know, obviously it was part of our ag tech strategy, investing in climate change. There, 80% of the workforce is women. And so is 80% of your workforce being women a good ESG strategy or a bad ESG strategy? I think I leave that for the LPs to decide. I provide the data and then I wait for the feedback to come back from the LPs to make a more reasonable assessment of whether the companies are following right kind of ESG practices or not. And if there is a lot of resistance to some of the data that we provide back, which is qualitative, we create consensus among our LPs to find out what they think. And then we, you know, have to design, or we make those decisions going forward in the future and make, you know, and consider, take those considerations in while investing in additional companies in our portfolio.
Got it.
And so in other words, we put the onus of ESG considerations in the lap of our LPs, who then provide their feedback that enables us to be more cognizant and better investors from an ESG perspective.
Got it. And that makes sense, because I believe it is such a big part of the conversation and an important conversation to have these goals in place, that some of these decisions and structures might be best dictated by the sources of capital as well. So I agree with that. Just however, that there's an increasing prevalence of greenwashing within companies. For the context of our listeners, greenwashing would mean when companies that provide misleading or just outright false information about their environmental impact. Have you seen, obviously without naming, but have you seen instances where, what are the common ways in which you've seen that you've been able to filter those, filter that noise out from TruSignal when evaluating companies?
Yeah, so very interesting question, because we were actually asking the companies that we were investing in to not only provide their operating metrics, but also to convert those operating metrics into carbon dioxide emissions saved or sequestered. And we started finding that different companies with very similar zero emission kilometers generated as a result of their activities were providing vastly different numbers on their carbon dioxide emissions sequestered or saved. And what we realized was that there was no standardization, source for the conversion of those metrics. So what we did was, I don't think there was an intention to greenwash, but just the lack of, standard metrics available for conversion meant that companies were using their own discretion to convert their operating metrics into metrics that were important from an ESG perspective. So we took that out from them and we said that we will now standardize the metrics based on the research that we had done. So now what happens is we just ask the companies to provide their operating metrics to us. And we then do the conversion and bring all the companies on the same platform as far as comparisons is concerned. And then, like I said earlier, in order for us to trends, we look at how those operating metrics are changing from month to month basis, and if there are declining trends, then we go back to speak to the companies to ask them what they're doing differently in their business that's leading to more emissions or less sequestration or less emissions saved. And then we provide our inputs to how enable them to actually come back on track, you know, in terms of what they were doing and possibly even, you know, do a better job going forward. But I don't think that as none of our companies have actually engaged in any greenwashing per se. There may have been differences in numbers being given on the same emission per kilometer, emission per zero emission kilometer. But that was because they were using different sources to do their calculations, which now we do at our end.
Makes sense. And that obviously standardizes the reporting as well for your LPs.
It standardizes the reporting. Absolutely correct.
Makes sense. And a lot of it being dictated by LPs themselves, I guess it standardizes the entire value chain, because my sense is if they invest in a separate fund in a separate geography, they might ask for the same. And hopefully over time, we converge on certain standards that are global in nature. And that just makes this whole space easier to navigate for an outside.
That
makes sense. So a million-dollar question that that is always posed with ESG investing is that, is this a pretext for investment underperformance? Does it lead to tolerating poorer results than purely looking at investing just from a capital growth lens? And what gives you conviction that both can coexist, given you've bet your career on starting GFC, which is precisely focused on marrying these two?
So first of all, I have a number of things to say in that regards. It's really interesting when people make you know, claims like that and expect those claims to be true for all periods under consideration. It all depends on when that claim is being made. So for example, in a very, very bull, you know, kind of a very strong market for startups where capital is abundantly available, you know, there's a massive fear of missing out element. Surely, you know, sustainable investing companies will underperform their pure tech counterparts because they have less volatility on both the downside as well as the upside. So in a market which is actually moving one direction upside, they will obviously underperform. But what I would do is basically ask those same people making those claims that in a market like what we are right now and over the last 6 to 8 months, where significant number of technology companies' valuations are corrected from the top, whereas the sustainable companies' investments have not corrected because there still remains a very, very strong demand for sustainability-led investing, climate change kind of investing, then the volatility on the downside has saved you. So on a risk-adjusted return basis, where you look at the Sharpe ratios, so just looking at returns without looking at the risk associated with those returns or the volatility associated with those returns, I'm not quite sure, based on my own experience and what I've seen over the markets, especially over the last 12 months, that sustainable investments have actually underperformed. If anything, I would say that on a risk-adjusted basis, they've outperformed. And in our space particularly, which is basically the venture space where the technologies that we are investing in represent the largest markets, you know, like transition, energy transition, and mobility and food tech and ag tech. The combination of both a transition, you know, to green, the fact that there aren't too many companies that are available, first of all, to invest in that transition. And then the fact that climate change and sustainability are additional tailwinds, you know, have meant that our returns have been excellent from a valuation mark-to-market perspective. Obviously, we've only been around for under 24 months and we haven't exited any of our investments. But this is the incremental rounds that the companies have done relative to where we've invested, we've only seen markups on our investments. So had we invested in pure tech companies some of them have been absolutely crushed from a valuations perspective.
Absolutely.
So I would really question that claim that sustainable investing is an underperforming strategy.
I think the right way to put that would be investors using that strategy to mask the underperformance is bad, but doesn't mean the investing strategy is bad in the first place.
Absolutely. Correct. Well said.
So I think that was all very well articulated on how you've differentiated your own returns. This conversation has been incredible. We have ranged a ton of topics. Towards the end, I always love asking our guests, what advice would you have for young MBAs and professionals just starting their career? What would you tell them?
So my advice would be, do what you love doing. And that should actually drive your choice of career. If you love what you do, then you don't work a single day in your life. It's a passion. Now, having said that, I would also say that over time, as you grow older, it's been many years since I got my MBA now, I've realized that, commercial considerations, if I have to actually go back and look at, the generation of my time, investment banking, management, consulting were the areas where a lot of MBAs focused the bulk of their energy. And obviously, during my time, there wasn't any significant interest in startups, although now a lot of youngsters are going into startups. But the point is that making money should not be the prime consideration of how you choose your career. And choosing a career that gives you greater satisfaction in terms of creative as well as intellectual involvement in the long term will pay you much higher dividends than a career in which you can actually, where you'll have huge amount of volatility in monetary compensation, but where going to work becomes a drag and the only thing that's actually driving you to work is the amount of money that you make. So that's one. And secondly, I've had a lot of people, a lot of kids reach out to me recently. And one piece of advice I've given to them is, what do you want to be remembered by when you stop doing what you're doing? And what you want to be remembered by is, what is the legacy you've created? And, your children, your children's children will play a very important role in creating that view. And for me, what I've decided to focus on is to make the world a much cleaner and healthier place for our future generations. And therefore, try to marry what I love doing the most, which is basically investing, with an area where I want to be remembered from a legacy building perspective, which is a healthier, cleaner environment for our kids going forward. And so something on that lines, if people were to use as a framework for deciding what to do, that would be, very, very fulfilling, I can assure you.
And absolutely. And something that even we hear a lot during our school years on where the future, to the capitalists, where the future value will be created, and to people who want to change the world, where there's the maximum potential to use our talents and knowledge to change the world.
Absolutely.
So, incredible conversation, Sandeep. Thank you so much for taking up time and sharing with us all these inputs on a variety of topics. Really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Nan. Thanks for offering me the opportunity to do that. And thank you to Wharton India Economic Forum as well for providing this honor.
Thank you so much. To learn more about Wharton India Economic Forum, please head to our website, www.whartonindia.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram for more updates.